The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA, we are on board with you.
It's time once again for KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm your host, Mike Mason. Coming up today, we'll travel to the Quijack River to look at a project to document the millions of sockeye smolt exiting Iliamna Lake, headed for the sea. We'll also get a preview of what to expect this fishing season in the Nooshigak and Naknek Quijack districts. All of that and more on today's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. You're listening to KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm Mike Mason. For the last few weeks, millions of sockeye smolt have been leaving the major lakes in the Bristol Bay region headed for the saltwater. They will be back in a couple of years as the adult sockeye that power the bay's massive commercial fishery. For the last 6 years, a project has been ongoing on the Quijack River to count the migrating smolt in an effort to better document the health and the productivity of the Iliamna Lake system. As part of that project, a small team of technicians go out every night at this time of year and collect a sample of 600 smolt from a location about 2 miles downriver from the lake. Some of the technicians work for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, while others work for BBEDC's Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute. Both are partnering on the project. The technicians use a small pontoon raft with what looks like a sluice box in the center. When the darkness hits, they drop the apparatus into the Quijack River and start collecting smolt. They are collected in intervals in an attempt to get samples from different segments of the overall biomass. Every 5 minutes, about 100 smolt are dipped out of the collection box and dumped into a 5-gallon bucket. This is done 6 times to make up the sample that is then taken back to the fishing game bunkhouse in Igiagic, where the technicians collect genetic and scale samples, along with taking length measurements that allowed them to determine if the smolt spent 1 or 2 years in the lake. Michael Link has been spearheading the reemergence of the smolt counting projects in Bristol Bay. He works for the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute and LGL Alaska Research Associates. He says the practice of collecting samples at time intervals is done so that it's possible to estimate the composition from the different drainages in the lake system.
So there's about 90 stocks that individually breeding genetically identifiable stocks in Iliamna and Lake Clark. And so Fish and Game and BBSRI submitted a proposal to see if we could estimate the relative production from the different drainages. And just like at Port Moeller, except you're down into the within basin identification, so how many come from, there's a drainage here called the Copper River, there's Lake Clark, there's several stocks up there, and they're trying to estimate the composition of the smolt run. The beach spawners in the lake, so the lake, a lot of the fish are composed of the beach spawners, they're trying to look at the relative production of these different spawning stocks and whether they contribute proportionately or disproportionately to the smolt run.
The Bristol Bay sockeye run is among the most documented salmon runs on Earth, but there are some very large holes in the data, including estimates of how many smolt leave the various river systems in the spring. Michael Link says combining the smolt data with the data collected annually by ADF&G can provide a much clearer picture of the health and the productivity of the Quijack River's sockeye run. However, he says the sampling is necessary to determine if the age of the smolt includes spending 1 or 2 years in the freshwater environment. General wisdom is that the longer a fish spends in the freshwater, the greater chance of surviving once they hit the marine environment. Again, Michael Link with BBSRI.
Fish of bigger, of larger size, even if they're the same age but they're larger, tend to have higher survival. They can survive fast periods of fasting or no food if they enter the north, enter the Bering Sea, and they don't encounter a lot of food. The bigger they are, the longer they're going to last between feeding events, etc. So they just in general have an aggregate higher survival rate. And it might vary from 5 to 15%. So one in 20 fish survives or one in 7 fish survives across the sizes you see in the buckets here. So the bigger fish, you might get as high as 10 or 15% survival. The really small ones, 3 to 5% survival. But of course, to stay another year in fresh water, you're subjecting yourself to adverse conditions there, right? These fish, you've got to get to sea and grow really fast and big. And so there's a trade-off. You stick around another year, you might not make it. You might be eaten by some birds or some seals or some sea otters or river otters. And so there's always a trade-off on where you should spend your time evolutionarily.
Documenting the outmigration of smolt in any river in Bristol Bay can be very challenging, with limitations in the effectiveness of the sonar technology and the inherent challenges of trying to conduct a project in such a remote location. Link says the effort is especially difficult in a river like the Quijack, where things are very dynamic.
The Quijack is a fairly compressed smolt run, probably the most compressed, and they have a lot of predators in the river on their downward migration, and they also have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of belugas that are feeding on them at the mouth. And so it's probably an adaptation to get out in en masse, safety in numbers, and get through and get out into the open ocean.
Once the 600 smolt samples from the different schools of fish are collected, the technicians then return the sampling raft to the shoreline, and they head back to Igiagic, where they will spend the next few overnight hours collecting the genetic and the other data that is used to analyze the Quijack River smolt run. Corey Graham is one of the technicians working on the project. Among his responsibilities is to collect the data from the sonar counters. Graham showed off a visual representation of the balls of smolt that pass over the sonar modules.
This is kind of what we're looking for. This is just the echogram, the output from the sonar. So this file is an hour, so you can just kind of scroll through. As you see, sometimes there's a bunch of smolt balls, sometimes you won't see anything. And this is just from one pod. So we have on this site, we have four pods or this array. And then sometimes you'll get wakes, and you can usually tell from the surface will be disturbed, and then it looks kind of different. Sometimes wind will show up.
The amount of data collected as part of the project is quite large, with about 24 gigabytes a day of data that must be downloaded from battery-powered servers located in a tent on the shore, just up from where the sonar modules are placed in the Quijack River. Michael Link notes that they have to use the technology to extrapolate how many smolt are within the smolt balls that are recorded traveling downriver during the two major pulses of smolt that occur over about a 14-day period in late May and early June.
The sound wave hits the bladder, comes back, and so all that is in a digital form, and you can actually analyze it more than just this visual way, right? So you get those the density of the school will change, it'll be portrayed on this screen as a different color. But the file, you can actually figure out the total energy that's come back from that school, and you know the energy that comes off one fish. Right? You're not echo counting. Echo counting, you go one fish, two fish, three fish, which you do with adult fish. Here, you're just taking that total energy because they're so close together, you can't distinguish individuals. You can see some individuals in the echogram, but when they're like that, you can't count individuals. So you use a different technique to analyze those data, but it's a rich data stream.
The sonar technology used to count the smolt in the Quijack River was specifically designed for use in Bristol Bay. Instead of looking across the river, the sonar modules are placed on the bottom and they look up through the water column. Chris Seawright works for the Division of Commercial Fisheries, and he checks the sonar arrays every day to make sure they are upright and working. Seawright says the first of the two sonar arrays is placed about a mile downriver in a location where the water doesn't swirl as much as other locations in the Quijack River.
You get the boils in the water, so when you have that up, you know, farther up locations where the current is stronger, it pretty much makes a lot of noise and, you know, air bubbles and stuff on the sonar. So down here, there's not as many, and you're able to see the smolt schools better when they go down.
The two sonar arrays in the Quijack River were put in on May 19th, and Seawright says they will be pulled about June 13th or 14th. After that, all of the data will be taken to Anchorage, where researchers with ADF&G, BBSRI, and LGL Alaska Research Associates will analyze it and prepare a report on the 2013 project. That report will likely come out sometime early next year. Last year, the total sockeye salmon smolt abundance was estimated at just over 49 million at the first sonar site and 47 million at the second site. It's estimated that only 1 in 10 to 1 in 20 smolt actually survive to return as adult sockeye. Last year's Iliamna Lake smolt will likely come back next year, or in 2015 for the three ocean fish. Counting smolt in Bristol Bay is nothing new, with projects dating back to the 1960s, but by 2002, all of the projects run by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game were discontinued. Because smolt counts provide a wealth of information about survival in the freshwater environment, a renewed effort was started, and the first digitally based sonar system was tested in the Quijack River in 2008. Since that time, the smolt counting effort has been expanded to the Ugashik and Igigik rivers. BBSRI's Michael Link says using smolt counts to inform preseason forecasts takes time and a consistent data set.
And we're just now entering into a period where we're going to begin to compare smolt abundance to adult return. So this is the sixth season, so we've had five annual estimates off of here. So there's only been a couple years where we've had out returns. You need a time series or a relationship between smolt run and subsequent return to start to use it for forecasting. So that'll probably come online over the next, from now forward, we'll start to know that if half as many smolts went out, maybe the run's going to be a bit smaller. And so we're just establishing that now. And that's one of the problems with smolt projects. The real value doesn't occur until year six and onward. And so it's a big investment up front to develop the time series. And you need a bit of staying power, financial support to keep it going for a while. And we're now entering that point with this thing. We've seen some interannual variability. We've seen some pretty good interannual variability, even though the escapements varied a bit. And so it's informative.
The smolt counting projects in Bristol Bay are funded by BBSRI, the City of Pilot Point, the Pilot Point Tribal Council, the Alaska Sustainable Salmon Fund, and BBSRI's benefactors, which include Alaskan Leader, Bristol Leader, Arctic Fjord, and Arctic Storm. This year's smolt run out of Iliamna Lake come from the 2010 and 2011 sockeye runs to the Quijack River, and the majority of this year's smolt will come back to the river in 2015 as two ocean fish. A much smaller percentage will return to the river in 2016 as three ocean fish. This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report on listener-supported public radio, KDLG.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is made possible in part by AIFMA, the Alaska Independent Fishermen's Marketing Association, 1-800-816-3741.
You're listening to KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. The commercial fishing season in the Naknek-Quijack District officially opened up on June 3rd, but there's been little to no effort because the sockeye have not yet showed up. Through June 21st, the district is operating under a weekly fishing schedule that runs from Mondays at 9 a.m. to Fridays at 9 a.m. Commercial fishing is currently allowed throughout the entire Naknek-Quijack District for the set netters, but in just the Naknek section for the drifters. The ADF&G area management biologist for the district is Slim Morstad. He says that once the weekly fishing schedule ends on June 21st, fishermen need to stand by for announcements about when and where to go fishing.
I'll look at, what the catches were that week, and if they were slow and nothing really great, we'll, go on hold and I'll send a test boat out Sunday, Monday, start looking around. See, if there's any fish moving in and, determine when we start, and we'll just go like we have in the past, one tide a day and see where we're at until we need to do, two tides a day or back off, and we'll just go from there.
The test fishery referenced by Morstad is done by drift net vessels that are authorized to conduct sets in various locations known to be where the sockeye enter and pass through the district. Morstad says for the most part the test boat is sent to locations within the Naknek section.
I'll have the boat go down to the Johnson Hill, they'll test out there, and then they'll work their way back and hit ships, and then they'll go up to, up the graveyard, or not up the graveyard because they'll stay in the Naknek section, but they'll go out to Libertyville and and then hit the mouth of the nacknik so I can see if I got any fish going into the river.
As most fishermen know, there are a number of variables that govern when and where sockeye start moving through the commercial fishing districts, but there are some patterns. However, Morstad says those patterns can change and deviate from year to year and even day to day.
There'll be some years where, you know, the fish will come, you know, to the west side and come in and cut across through ships. And that's where, you know, been going out to the Johnson Hill, you're not catching much. Last couple of years, they've been coming, you know, down the Johnson Hill line and coming into the district out, you know, on the east side. So there hasn't been a whole lot coming in to the beaches or, you know, up the west side. And it just changes.
The total run to the Naknek-Wejack District this year is forecasted at 10.6 million sockeye. If that turns out to be correct, the commercial harvest could be around 5.6 million fish. The escapement goal for the Wejack River will be 2.5 million, but the escapement goal for the river can be changed in season based on an assessment of the actual run. The Naknek-Wejack District often features the largest drift net fleet of all the districts in the bay, but for the most part, the drifters are limited to just fishing in the Naknek section early in the season. Morstad says there are a number of factors the department considers before allowing the drifters to head into the Wejack section, including the allocation plan that calls for 84% of the harvest to be done by the drifters and 16% by the set netters. The set net allocation is then broken out with 8% for the Naknek section set netters and 8% for the Wejack section set netters.
Based on genetics and we, you know, in the commercial catch, I know we can take, there's times we're fished the Naknek section and the catch is more than half, it's, you know, it could be 60% Wejack fish in that. So we're catching Wejack fish in the Naknek section by itself. If the set net fleet are at 8 or 6 or 7%, and, you know, my escapement, I haven't taken any big hits and we're just chugging along just fine, we'll stay in the Naknek section. I mean, there's no point in going over there. We're catching plenty of Wejack fish. My goal, I'm on track for my goal. I'm not ahead of myself and I'm not behind. But once I start getting ahead in my escapement, and then, you know, we may have to go over there and fish a tide and then come back like we did last, you know, in 2012. But I don't want to keep going back and forth where we fish one tide, come back for 2 days or 3 days. It's just, and then go back over there. Once I know, I like to go over there. I want to be able to, you know, do one tide a day or something like that so I can spread the fleet out more consistently.
The practice of limiting fishing pressure within the Wejack section was put in place in an effort to protect the sockeye run to the Wejack River, which has been in a rebuilding phase for many years. Morstad says his goal is to allow consistent time to fish in the Wejack section if it's warranted by the escapement.
What I don't want to do is, you know, early on, do one tide and then sit for five days without going over there, because number one, it sends a signal out to the entire bay that we're going to be going over there, and if fishing's not so good in another district, I may get 100 boats transferring because they think we're going to be over there, and that's typically what the signal is, and that's typically what I've done, is once we start fishing over there, we do it on a consistent basis. And if I go over there too early, I could get another 100, 150 boats transferring in here, and we don't go over there.
Last year, the sockeye run to the Naknek-Wejack District was 4% above the forecast. The harvest was recorded at nearly 10 million sockeye. Actual escapement to the Wejack River was recorded at 4.1 million fish, and escapement to the Naknek River was recorded at 900,000. Morstad says he saw indications early last season that the run to the district, especially the Wejack River, would be larger than anticipated preseason.
We saw it in the genetics at Port Mueller. You know, Wejack started high, and it stayed, you know, right up there with a little bit behind Igigake, you know, in the very beginning, and Igigake was stronger, but it stayed up there above the Naknek. It was like the second largest, and that gave us an indication. I went and fished over there on the 30th of June. It was too early, but I went and flew, and it looked like we had, you know, 500,000 to 600,000 fish in the river. So it was, and that was early on, you know, that was on the 29th. And so that was a, you know, a lot of fish for that point in time. And it was, you know, it was matching what we were seeing at Port Mueller. So that gave us a thought. It gave us something to watch. So it certainly was the biggest indicator.
One of the priority points of emphasis for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in recent years across Bristol Bay has been to stress the importance of fishermen recording king salmon harvested as incidental catch in the sockeye fishery. Fishermen are still allowed to sell or even keep kings as a home pack, but those kings need to be recorded on an ADF&G fish ticket at the time of landing. Last year, just over 17,000 kings were harvested commercially in Bristol Bay, but Morstad believes the actual harvest was much larger.
I know we catch a lot more than what's, you know, being accounted for in fish tickets. And, you know, and even during the summer, you know, during the commercial fishing period, kings are sold at sockeye. They go into a bag, you know, and then they're dumped in. So, and they're not assorted out until they get to the processing plant. And then, you know, it's hard. Then how do you go back and, you know, and they pull those kings out and put them in a tote. And there's always a lot more, you know, more kings than what's gone on fish tickets. But, and they're not supposed, you know, you're supposed to separate them, but they don't.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has not yet started counting sockeye escapement to the Naknek and Kwajak Rivers. Escapement to the Kwajak River is done at counting towers set up just downriver from Igiagig, and the towers should be up and counting on June 20th. The counting towers on the Naknek River should be providing escapement information by June 19th or 20th. The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report will continue in just a moment. This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report on listener-supported public radio KDLG. I'm your host, Mike Mason. The commercial sockeye fishery in the Nooshigak District on the west side of Bristol Bay is still likely at least a couple of weeks away, but fishermen, processors, and other stakeholders are getting ready in earnest. Last year, the sockeye run to the Nooshigak District was counted at just over 4 million fish. That was well below the preseason forecast of just over 6.5 million sockeye. This year's forecast is for a run of 5.2 million fish with 3.3 million sockeye anticipated to be available for commercial harvest. The area management biologist for the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District is Tim Sands. He outlined what fishermen can expect this season during the most recent Business of Fish workshop in Dillingham. Sands began by stressing the unusually large runs that returned to the Nooshigak District between 2003 and 2010.
Every single year was a top 10 year. We had just tremendous runs. Three of those years are now the top 3 years since 1883. So well over 100 years worth of fisheries in Nooshigak District. And the top 3 years have been since 2003. And that's really incredible. So we've been really fortunate, but you don't, our average harvest in this district is about 5 million fish. And you don't have a 5 million average by catching 7 million fish every year. You have to have some years that are below average. And that's what we're seeing right now. We had a 2.8 million harvest last year. The forecast for Nooshigak is 3.3 million harvest this year. And it's just the balancing out of the scales to get back to the 5 million or so average harvest.
Last year's sockeye escapement to the Wood River was counted at 764.2 thousand fish, which was within the escapement goal range of 700,000 to 1.5 million sockeye. Sockeye escapement to the Nooshigak River was counted at 432.4 thousand fish, which also was within the escapement goal range of 340,000 to 760,000 fish. Sand stressed that nothing is wrong with the sockeye run to the Nooshigak District.
We get our escapement and things are healthy, but some years the fish survive better than other years. One of the kind of pet theories out there is this cold water in the Bering Sea affects early marine survival of the outmigrating fish. And in some cases, maybe Nooshigak fish are more susceptible to that than, say, Kwijak fish. So Kwijak might have a little bit better run on these cold, when we have these cold springs, and Nooshigak fish might do less well. It's all kind of speculation. There's not really long-term data sets that can prove it either way, but we've definitely had some really cold springs the last several years, and several of us think that is part of the issue and why we're having lower survival for our returning salmon for Nooshigak.
The Nooshigak district is different than the other commercial fishing districts in Bristol Bay, which have weekly fishing schedules. There is no set fishing schedule in the Nooshigak. Instead, all fishing time is announced via emergency order. Sands anticipates letting the drift and set net fleets go once the escapement count hits 100,000 fish in the Wood River.
Part of that is because when the King Run is low, that's part of the management plan, but it just seems to work out pretty well that once we hit that 100,000, the Wood River kind of ramps up pretty quick and we want to be ready to fish. So we'll look for that 100,000 up the Wood River and we'll start counting on the 18th of June. And then we'll have set gillnet only openings kind of to just see what's out there. Because of the way the management plan is written and everything else, having a set gillnet opening in the morning gives us a lot of options as far as extending that opening and having put a drift opening on top of it, or just waiting for the next morning and see if things are picking up or not.
Sands asserts that he will be conservative in an attempt to get enough sockeye escapement to the Nooshigak River to avoid having to utilize the Wood River Special Harvest Area. Sands suggests that the factors are lined up this year to possibly allow the fleets to stay out of the Wood River.
The ratio between number of Wood River fish in the forecast and number of Nooshigak fish in the forecast is smaller. Last year it was over 3-1. This year it's less than 3-1, and that 3-1 is kind of a magical number because it's hard to catch all the Wood River fish if there's more than 3-1 without catching too many Nooshigak fish. If there's less than a 3-1 ratio, you can be conservative enough, still let some of the Wood River fish go by, which lets the Nooshigak fish go by without getting too high on the escapement on the wood.
ADF&G is predicting that the sockeye run to the Wood River will be about 3.4 million fish, with a sockeye run to the Nooshigak River of 1.3 million. One of the new things that fishermen in the Nooshigak District will have to be prepared for this season is the 4 3/4 inch mesh restriction approved by the Alaska Board of Fisheries at the December meeting focused on Bristol Bay. During his Business of Fish presentation, Sands explained the reasoning behind allowing the department to put in place a mesh restriction.
So the idea is that the Nooshigak fish are bigger and would be less susceptible to smaller gear. So if it looks like we're falling behind on the Nooshigak sockeye escapement, then we'll try and warn people, hopefully with 48 hours notice, that, hey, we're going to have to use this 4.75 inch mesh restriction, and then we'll institute it after we warn about it, give people time to change out gear. But the idea is that we'll catch more Wood River sockeye and less Nooshigak River sockeye with a smaller mesh.
The idea of allowing the department to use the 4.75 inch mesh restriction was not put forward by ADF&G. Instead, it was put forward by the Nooshigak Fish and Game Advisory Committee and ultimately approved by the Board of Fish for use this upcoming season. Basically, that means that fishermen should be prepared to use the smaller gear at some point this season. However, Sands is hopeful it will not be necessary to use the mesh restriction tool. Sands confirms that if the Wood River Special Harvest Area is used this year, things will be a little different thanks to another change approved by the Board of Fish.
If we do go in the Wood River Special Harvest Area, it's going to be separate gear type openings. It's no longer concurrent. So there'll be 3 drift openings and a set net opening. And the set net openings, the set netters aren't going to be required to be perpendicular to the bank or 100. You still have to be 150 feet away from any other net, but you can be anywhere in the river, in the open area of the river that you want. You don't have to be fishing off the beach. You can fish off islands. All that stuff has changed. So really look at the new regulations when they come out and be aware that things have changed. But like I said, hopefully we can avoid the Wood River this year.
Several other changes were approved back in December by the Board of Fisheries, including a provision that now allows drifters to have up to 200 fathoms of gear on board when in the Wood River Special Harvest Area. However, any gear over 75 fathoms must be in a bag. You're listening to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report on KDLG. Now to the other end of the fishery, where the sockeye end up in the hands of chefs plating it for eager consumers across the country. Of course, not all consumers, or chefs for that matter, know the different choices they have when eating salmon, nor are many aware of the unique story of Bristol Bay, its fish, and fishermen. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more on a Boston-based nonprofit organization that's working to introduce more chefs and consumers to Bristol Bay sockeye, while at the same time raising awareness about the fishery and its sustainability.
The nonprofit Chefs Collaborative out of Boston, Massachusetts, is gearing up for another year of getting Bristol Bay sockeye into the hands of chefs around the country, who can then share more about the product with their customers, typically as the fishing season is underway. Alicia Fowler is the program manager.
This is our second year doing this. It's a Bristol Bay Salmon Dinners, and we do them in collaboration with the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, and we host dinners across the country with chefs in our network to raise awareness and help protect Bristol Bay's wild sockeye salmon.
So far, 75 chefs have signed up to participate. That's about the same number as last year. Fowler says the dinner events range from a menu special that runs during the peak of the season to a three-course tasting menu, or even a dinner and a movie night featuring the documentary Red Gold. Make no mistake, the sustainability of the one-of-a-kind Bristol Bay sockeye resource is what Chefs Collaborative is hoping to tell others around the country all about.
Bristol Bay, Alaska is home to one of our nation's most incredibly valuable wild salmon fisheries. And as you know, every year approximately 37 million wild adult salmon return over just a few weeks between the end of June through mid-July. And so what we're doing is we're working with restaurants and food professionals across the country to raise awareness and to help educate their customers, the media, and the public about the salmon.
Not all salmon is equal, but not all consumers know that. So BBRSDA is helping Chefs Collaborative to include table cards with information about the product, and the chefs will have talking points to share with their customers and staff.
You know, so even if they just have a menu item for 2 months, they could still have their staff be trained to say, you're about to enjoy Bristol Bay wild sockeye salmon. Here's where it comes from. Here's when it's in season. But you can get it here year-round. Here's how. And so our goal really there is to educate folks and help them understand where the salmon's coming from. That it's not just mystery salmon, so to speak.
Fowler says even 1 year into the program, she's already seeing how important relationships can develop between chefs around the country and the fishermen in Bristol Bay.
If I can, I can share one story with you. We have a chef named Chef Josh Lewin of Beacon Hill Bistro here in Massachusetts. You know, he lives about 4,700 miles away from Bristol Bay, but last year he participated, and he talks about salmon as something that was important to him growing up as a kid in various forms. And then in 2012, he and the restaurant made a commitment to carry the fish fresh while it was in season in the early summer, and they worked with their suppliers to make it possible to purchase the fish from one small fishing family on the south side of Bristol Bay. And as a result, he's actually forged a closer relationship with a number of families there who have been fishing there for generations.
So fishermen, processors, others in the industry, your product will again be served to people who have maybe never heard of Bristol Bay, Alaska, or sockeye salmon, with chefs and staff on hand to tell them a little bit about it.
To everybody who's getting ready to go out there and start fishing for Bristol Bay sockeye, we're really excited to let you know that the fish that you're fishing for right now are going to be finding their way onto dinner plates across the country, where folks will be savoring Bristol Bay sockeye and also have the opportunity to learn a lot more about Bristol Bay.
The Chefs Collaborative website will have a map of locations the sockeye is being served at this year, as well as more information about the program and ways you can become involved helping protect the sustainability of the resource. For the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report, I'm Dave Benninger.
Salmon is a pretty versatile fish. You can smoke it, dry it, and grill it. Salmon can be eaten as steaks, spreads, or strips. The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute hopes people around the world may soon enjoy powdered salmon. KDLG's Ben Matheson has the story.
International food aid is big business. It's worth $2.8 billion in the U.S. alone. Alaska's fishermen and seafood processors have sold canned pink salmon for international food aid for about a decade, but demand is now outpacing supply.
There's just not enough of it. You know, the industry's done such a great job of diversifying their product line and increasing demand that we're just not producing the amount of canned pinks that there's a demand for.
Bruce Schockler is International Food Aid Director for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. He says the priority in food aid has shifted towards a scientific focus on nutrition and making food that's versatile, lightweight, shelf-stable, and able to fortify other foods. Combine those needs with current Alaska salmon processing, and you have the makings of salmon protein powder.
Between 40 and 50% of your fish, of that round fish, are going in the garbage. So you got a tremendous amount of product that is available for use, but it has to be handled like food, and it has to be handled with all the rules and regulations and FDA and all the things that it takes to extract that protein and put it into a human food form.
Salmon protein powder has been taken around the world for taste testing and pilot projects. The early word from Guatemala is that it tastes pretty good.
They just took powder and sprinkled it on a big tray full of vegetables, had a seafood salad. They loved it. We had one group that was interested in buying it as soon as it could be available, just to give the beans that their people were eating some flavor so that they would they'd like eating them better.
The governor's recently approved budget includes $300,000 to help bring the product overseas.
Put it into a feeding program and let people actually use it and work with it for like 6 months and come up with some real data and what the effects are and how well it's received, how it's used, what the nutritional values of it are in the diet, how it incorporates into their local food basket, so to speak.
The project also seeks to develop an underutilized Alaskan fish, herring. The vast majority of herring harvested in the state are used strictly for their roe. ASME is looking to can the actual fish. Undeveloped herring stocks stretching up the west coast of the state are a focus. Schockler says the economics, of course, have to work out.
It's all about whether you can make money doing it or not, and as the economics change in that market, we're hoping that whether it's in Kodiak or Dutch Harbor or Crystal Bay or something new clear up in Nome, we can bring something new and bring some value to this herring fishery.
In the first couple years of testing, ASME has sent a container of canned herring to Liberia with positive reviews. Schockler says the domestic market is also a huge opportunity for herring. The new state money is expected to fund 2 years of work on the salmon powder and herring projects. In Dillingham, I'm Ben Matheson.
That concludes this edition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report, which can be heard each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday during June and July at straight up 4 p.m. right here on listener-supported public radio KDLG. Until next time, please be safe and watch the weather. And by the way, here's hoping you find good fishing this season.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA. We are on board with you.